Hello, and welcome to session one of the Healthcare Private Equity Basic Training Digital Health M&A webinar series presented by Pulcinelli. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers throughout the webinar. If they are unable to answer during the live program, our speakers will connect with you via email afterwards. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. I would now like to turn the webinar over to Pulcinelli shareholder, Jonathan Henderson.
Hey, Catherine, thank you. Good morning or afternoon, depending on your time zone. I'm John Henderson. I have the pleasure today of moderating this first session in Pulcinelli's Healthcare Private Equity Basic Training Series for 2021. I'm a shareholder resident in our Dallas, Texas office. I'm a private equity and healthcare M&A lawyer, advising management teams, founders, operators, portfolio companies, and private equity and other investors in mergers and acquisitions, joint ventures, and other complex transactions in the business of healthcare. From a management and leadership standpoint within the firm, I serve as chair of the business services division, chair of our corporate and transactional practice group, and co-lead of our healthcare M&A practice. Our healthcare private equity basic training this year consists of four substantive sessions covering NDA and LOI terms, legal due diligence, data compliance, and key upcoming legislative updates. Our premise in standing up this training and its scope is that there are a handful of legal and quasi-legal issues and concepts that are foundational for non-lawyer advisors, investors, and lenders to know in order to get healthcare deals done effectively. Successfully investing in, owning, and operating healthcare service businesses is full of nuances and years of learning. There are concepts and interplay between rules that are mysterious as someone is learning how to think about how healthcare is owned, organized, paid for, and delivered in America, as I think back over my 30 years of having been advising in this sector. We intend to break down some of those foundational knowledge points in this basic training where you can begin to learn how things work and also fill in gaps if you've been active in the sector for a while. Last year's training delivered during July and August 2020 covered structure, healthcare M&A issues, reimbursement, and distress deals. As we begin planning our 2022 program now, if you have insights or suggestions as you experience this year's program, we'd love to hear from you and incorporate those. You can find additional information at www.healthcarema.pulcinelli.com. At that website, you'll also find information about other initiatives of our healthcare M&A practice, including our annual Healthcare Dealmakers Conference, the HDC Quarterly Market Updates, the 10-Minute Health Biz Cast, and the Healthcare Prime White Paper Series. The writings in our White Paper Series are posted at the website and include The Shaping of Healthcare in America Through M&A and Innovation, The Emergence of Supergroups, The Strategic Role of Systematic Healthcare M&A in Remaking the Future of Healthcare, and the Strategy for Value Creation in the Home Care Industry. A fifth white paper issuing this month focuses on investment activity resulting from the accelerated shift to telehealth and telemedicine in the wake of COVID-19 within the analytical framework of the Healthcare Prime Series. For those in our audience who are growing healthcare enterprises through serial acquisitions, the two white papers issued in May 2020 and April 2021 will be particularly useful resources. Along with issuing those two white papers on programmatic M&A, we began our first consulting-like project earlier this year, advising one of our private equity-sponsored home health and hospice company platform companies on developing their own playbook for creating a sustainable M&A operating model to achieve their inorganic growth goals. If you'd like to learn more about that consulting service, please don't hesitate to reach out. Finally, before we go into today's program, I want to express Pulcinelli's sincere gratitude to our audience. To a person in one or more roles, many of you are on the front lines or supporting those that are on the front lines through capital and your expertise of providing healthcare. We thank you for your grit you're demonstrating as our nation's healthcare ecosystem continues to battle through its now second year of the COVID pandemic. We pray for safety for and health for you and your families and your organizations, your communities, and our nation. Let me introduce our four panelists today: Josh Reynolds, Oliver Davis, Jessica Norris, and Mike Dolan, who you'll hear more about as the day plays out, or as the program plays out. Today, the panel is going to be covering NDA and LOI terms, keeping the momentum at the beginning of the deal. These panelists are fantastic healthcare M&A lawyers and will be great teachers for today's content. Before I turn the panel over, a second about Pulse Nellie's healthcare M&A practice. As the name suggests, this practice is a team of experienced M&A lawyers who have a depth of experience in the healthcare industry. As a function of the convergence of our middle market M&A and healthcare regulatory focuses, we're uniquely positioned to advise on deals in all sectors in the healthcare industry. Our firm has advised on healthcare deals over the past 3 years with an aggregate value in excess of $41 billion that have ranged from hospital system mergers to dental and medical practice roll-ups to healthcare technology platform acquisitions and pretty much every other sector and deal structure in between. We can tackle any healthcare transaction and help our clients identify and solve for risk at a level of complexity and detail that comes from developing a fully integrated team of experts. If you'd like to learn more, again, the website, www.healthcarema.pulsenelli.com. And now for the program. Please feel free to type questions and comments in the chat section of the Zoom meeting, and our team will be able to pick those up during the program. If we don't get to your question during the presentation, then please reach out and someone will be back in touch. Josh, before I turn the program over to you, let me introduce you briefly. So Josh Reynolds is a shareholder at our healthcare M&A practice, resident in our San Francisco office. He has developed an experienced knowledge base in advising on complex, multi-state, multi-site healthcare deals and is the leader of this basic training initiative, taking it from concept to now in its second year. With that, Josh, take it away.
Thank you, John. So first, I'm going to introduce a hypothetical. We get that up on the slide, please, which all of our presenters today will reference back to during their presentations to sort of give you a real life situation to the material we are discussing. So I'll just quickly read through it. Big Name Capital is looking to expand its presence in the digital health sector. It is looking at many telehealth companies in order to acquire majority ownership. One potential target, Need to See a Doc LLC, a technology-based video platform, has sent over a non-disclosure agreement that includes a non-solicit provision. Need to See a Doc LLC's capitalization table includes multiple founders, venture capital investors, and a large pool of current and former employees with vested restricted stock. Big Name Capital wants the founders and the venture capitalists to jointly and severally indemnify all indemnity obligations. So basically no chasing down former employees. Big Name Capital also wants to sign the purchase agreement as fast as possible after signing the letter of intent. And they know that other private equity shops are also interested in Need to See a Doc LLC. So let's get started. So I'd like to introduce Jessica Norris, who's a shareholder in our Kansas City office in the healthcare M&A group. And Jessica, what are the key areas of a non-disclosure agreement to discuss with your attorney?
Yeah, so the non-disclosure agreement goes by a couple of different names. Some people refer to it as an NDA for short. It also is referred to as a confidentiality agreement. So if you hear those terms, they're all referring to the same exact document. The NDA is the first step in the M&A process. Before you begin discussions and disclosing any information, you need to have an NDA in place. Especially, it protects not only the disclosing party's confidential information, but sets the scope for the recipient as well on what they can and cannot do with that information. So it does protect both parties. Typically in an M&A transaction, the NDAs are one way. So they're just there to protect the target or the disclosing party, because typically the purchaser is not providing confidential information to the target. Unlike most of a letter of intent, a non-disclosure agreement is a binding agreement on the parties. And so once you sign it, you are legally bound to comply with its terms. Next slide. So the general elements of a non-disclosure agreement, which we will go into in detail, are parties and scope, defining what is confidential information and how the parties are allowed to use the confidential information provided, term of the obligations of the parties, and then there are several other special provisions that are typically found in a standard NDA. So the first area is parties and scope. Now, the issue is you have the two parties, but parties generally have representatives that are going to be actually receiving the information. So not only are you identifying the legal parties to the NDA, you're also wanting to define who those representatives are of those parties and who receives that information. You want to, as a disclosing party, limit as much as you can those persons that have access and receive your confidential information. So typically you will define representatives of, especially the recipient, to say that only certain employees, and it's usually higher level employees with a need to know basis, are to receive the confidential information. And this is one of the areas I think gets overlooked in the beginning because everyone's worried about who the parties are and they don't focus on who's actually physically, individually receiving this information. So in a one-way NDA, sorry, can you go back? In a one-way NDA, the disclosing party, it gives all the information and the receiving party is typically referred to just as the recipient. So not only do you provide a reference for how they share the confidential information of the third parties, it's whether there are any other third parties bound by the NDA. So if the recipient wants to disclose the information received to third-party consultants, debt or equity financing parties, that should be covered in the NDA. And if they are allowed to disclose to these third parties, there are two different routes. Typically, there is one that says the third party must acknowledge receipt of the NDA and understand that they are bound by those provisions. Some recipients think that is too cumbersome. And if they do, then the other alternative is to make the recipient liable for any breach by a third party to whom which they disclose. And you also typically want a provision that requires the disclosing party to notify the third party receiving the confidential information of the NDA and the provisions therein, so that even if they're not signing acknowledgement, they're aware this information is confidential. Now, having the recipient be on the hook for any breach by the third party will typically keep the recipient and the third party both honest and make sure that everyone is aware of these confidentiality obligations. So the scope of the NDA should be limited to simply the disclosure of the confidential information for the purpose of evaluating a transaction. You want to make sure that scope is very limited. And if confidential information is being shared by the parties for other business reasons, those should be in a separate NDA. So that other sharing of information not related to evaluating a proposed transaction, licensing, et cetera, should have its own NDA with a separate scope so that the remains very limited in what is being provided and who the representatives are that have access to that information. We typically put in a very clear that the information provided by the discloser is provided on an as-is basis without warranty. So you're not being held to a rep and warranty standard that everything you're providing is true and accurate and complete. That's not what you want to get into a lawsuit over if the transaction does not proceed. So that's a big part that I don't think most people take into account. It's usually in the boilerplate. We just need to make sure that it is always in the boilerplate. Next slide. So first you're going to want to define what constitutes confidential information. The recipient will try to narrow what constitutes confidential information for just those written materials marked as confidential or proprietary. This is a very limited definition of confidential information. So if you are the discloser, you are going to want to have the confidential information definition be as broad as possible. And those parameters should include any and all formats of how information is shared, whether that's oral, visual, written, electronic. And you don't want to have to expressly mark the information labeled as confidential to make it confidential. So if you're the discloser, you want this as broad as possible. You don't want to have someone accidentally disclose a document, not stamp it confidential, and then all of a sudden it's outside of the scope of the NDA. We also usually insert a provision that requires the recipient receiving your confidential information to maintain its confidentiality using the same care it uses to protect its own confidential information. And so to further clarify that, we also say, but not less than a reasonable degree of care. Because if for some reason your recipient is willy-nilly with protecting its confidential information, you don't want to be held to that standard. So you always want to make sure that you always include the reasonable degree of care concept in the NDA on the protection. Further, obviously, disclosing confidential information would not only cause monetary damages to the disclosing party, but the disclosing party should also have the right to seek an immediate injunction to prevent further disclosure of the confidential information. And having that express right to seek injunctive relief is extremely important in these scenarios. So we just generally have a few disclusions to what is confidential information, and these are fairly accepted and standard in the market. So if the information was previously known to the recipient and not subject to confidentiality, then that information is not deemed confidential information for purposes of the NDA. The other is if the information is publicly known. So to the extent you have released this information out into the public domain, you can't expect to have this person keep it under wraps because everyone already is aware of the issue or the information. The other point that's always inserted is that it is independently developed by the recipient. This is always kind of a minefield because it would be very difficult for a recipient to prove that they independently developed the information. So we also put in a no reverse engineering clause as well to further bolster this exception. So they can't reverse engineer your confidential information and say they independently developed it. So there is two parts to that piece that goes in later in the document. The other is if the recipient received the information from a third party who had no duty of confidentiality to the disclosing party. And then the final is a court order, or if it's a public company that is the purchaser or the recipient, then securities law disclosure will typically be an exception. If the transaction does not proceed, it's not consummated, typically you want to state what happens to the information. Is it returned or destroyed? Or is that the option of the disclosing party? Even if there is a return or destroy of confidential information, if the transaction does not proceed, there is still usually a clause that requires or allows the recipient legal counsel to retain a copy of the confidential information for evidentiary purposes. And this is if for later on there is a lawsuit over a breach of the NDA, their outside counsel has the information they need to defend that claim. In the United States, the term of an NDA is typically 1 to 5 years. It really does depend on the industry. I know in the UK, for example, the term is typically closer to 10 years. So there is a bit of a cultural difference between domestic and international NDAs. even if an expiration, and the whole point of the term is to make sure the confidential information at the expiration of the term is no longer valuable. So that's why it depends on the industry. In the tech industry, where things move extremely fast, 1 year may be more than sufficient because the confidential information is no longer valuable to the third party. But even if after the expiration of the term, it should be very clear that any intellectual property and trade secrets are still bound by general common law and does not expire just because the agreement does. So there is a slight carve out in the expiration. The other piece that we see is non-solicitation and non-hire of a disclosing party's employees. Now this term also has to have its own individual term. It's typically a year or two. I've seen it go as low as 6 months, but the scope of that is what is really important, because you want to, as a discloser, you want all your employees to be subject to this non-solicitation. However, as a purchaser, the concern is that you're going to inadvertently breach this provision. And so there's typically customary carve-outs regarding general solicitations. However, the more you limit the scope of which employees are subject to the non-solicitation, the more successful you can be as a disclosing party and also having a no hire. So, you know, we don't care if you didn't know. You can't even hire this small subset group of employees. And as you narrow that scope of who these employees are that are subject to the non-solicitation, you can be more successful in getting a true no hire provision as well. A couple of other provisions that are typically found is that there's no obligation of the parties to consummate the transaction. You don't want the NDA to somehow infer that the parties are bound to enter into a transaction. So this is another belt and suspenders provision, but is often bound for clarification. The other big issue is governing law and jurisdiction. Obviously, the disclosing party wants it in their home court. The recipient wants the governing law and jurisdiction to be in their home court. So typically, parties just settle on Delaware, which has an established. One thing about private equity buyers is that they will also want to negotiate express authority in the NDA, permitting them to continue their ordinary course investment activities. That is a key issue if you have a private equity recipient of your confidential information. And private equity funds are also generally sensitive to the scope of those covenants and whether their portfolio companies are also subject to, especially the non-solicit. And so there are various ways to address that issue. As long as the portfolio company is not, you know, one of the representatives is not in charge of the portfolio company, does not have direct control over the portfolio company, you can get around that, but you need to be very careful that you don't eliminate that scope by carving out these portfolio companies carte blanche. And the same for affiliates. That's one that is usually highly negotiated. It's very specific to the transaction and the parties. The other big issue is financing sources. You know, there are some NDAs where you will distinguish between debt and equity financing sources. So it's not all financing sources, but you may want to parse that out. And sometimes we do it as in for, you know, it's prior written consent. And the point is, in the NDA, if there are multiple bidders, this is a first round, so you need to be much more sensitive in a first round NDA in a bid process than if you're in a bid process where they're now limited to the second round of potential bidders. So I have seen dual NDAs where a secondary NDA replaces the first one or is amended because they made it to the second round, and then they're allowed to have a broader scope of who they can disclose to. Next. So in our hypothetical, the non-disclosure agreement would be entered into before any information of the potential target is disclosed to big name capital. The non-disclosure agreement should address the affiliates and portfolio companies of big name capital and exactly who the quote representatives are that are receiving this information. And the non-solicitation provision will be key for the disclosing party as well as big name capital. But it should be carefully crafted to address length of term and define exactly which employees are subject to that restriction, as well as include any customary carve-outs.
Thank you so much, Jessica. That was great to hear. I know a lot of our audience sees a lot of NDAs come across, so it's great to see, you know, what they're actually agreeing to and the issue points that are in there.
Correct. NDAs are oftentimes handled in-house, and sometimes they do get a little sticky, and that's when you should call us.
Perfect. So we're going to stick on the topic of NDAs, but sort of flip over to the other side. What happens when you want to sell a company, and instead of getting tons of different NDAs from a bunch of companies, you are just trying to do one company, and you have the same NDA, but from a bunch of different bidders. So I'd like to introduce now Michael Dolan from our Denver office. And Michael, how does the NDA process work in an auction setting?
Good thing. Thanks, Josh. So, you know, I think a few things we want to talk about in relation to the auction process for an NDA. Like Josh said, we'll get to the sell side process too, to cover both sides of the coin. But first, a few thoughts on the buy side auction process. So, you know, I think the two main considerations that you will have when processing an NDA as a potential buyer are speed and compliance. You know, obviously the faster that you get through the NDA, the more quickly you get the SIM and other diligence materials, the quicker you can dive in to, you know, performing your diligence and hopefully get to an LOI. The compliance part is, you know, kind of self-explanatory, but we'll talk about a few key components of that too. So for the first consideration, speed. So how do you process these things quickly? You know, they're not very long documents usually, but as Jessica, you know, alluded to and talked about in some detail, the terms are, you know, really sticky, and there are a number of them that are, you know, subject to negotiation if you are reading closely as to what you're being bound by. So the first step that we would recommend in order to get these done quickly is to make sure that counsel is engaged before you even receive the NDA. You know, as both Josh and Jessica said, you may handle these in-house. You know, that certainly happens quite frequently. So if so, you can skip the counsel engagement steps, but it is, in our eyes, always a good step to have counsel available so that, you know, they can either do the first run through the NDA or just be available for any questions that you may have if the negotiations get sticky. The second step of that would be in connection with engaging counsel, you also want to make sure that counsel is not going to have any conflicts with the potential target whose NDA you're looking at. So the faster you can notify counsel of who the target is and they can start their conflict clearing process, that would also help speed things up. Next, this is a sort of optional term, but depending on how many of these you are reviewing at any given time, it could be helpful to discuss parameters of acceptable terms with your counsel. That way, you know, they don't need to flag items for your review to say, you know, for example, here they're going with a two-year non-solicit. Are you okay with that? To the extent you can pre-clear items like that with your attorneys, they can help push things through a little more quickly. The next item is use of the targets form. When you're in a buy-side process, you know, the target is going to be reviewing, you know, dozens, if not more, NDAs. They're likely going to have their own form. So if you can facilitate use of that form and, you know, do so without too many changes, you're probably going to be able to get through the NDA review process a little more quickly. You know, I know that there are some buyers who have have their own standard form that they prefer. Of course, I think, you know, all things equal, all buyers would prefer that. But, you know, in reality, and to keep things quicker, it's usually going to be faster for you, more helpful to the target to just use whatever form they provide to you. the last item is also a related point, but to the extent you can keep immaterial changes to a minimum, that would also help whoever is reviewing the changes on the other side process things more quickly and hopefully get to a resolution in a faster manner. And with respect to the compliance consideration, you know, I called out a few terms here. Obviously, there are a lot more as Jessica described, but some of the compliance concerns are more, you know, administrative. Can you keep tabs on these things? Can you make sure that you are abiding by the terms of the NDA? You know, not items that you would necessarily violate or breach because of any wrongful act, but just because it's hard to keep track of. So, for example, destroying or returning the information, or being able to retain materials on your servers after that material is required to be sent back to the target. And then the other item I called out there is the non-solicit. Jessica talked about that one a lot as well, but that's one of the more important business terms, something that you want to make sure that you can comply with both from an administrative point of view in terms of, you know, general solicitations on LinkedIn, but also in making sure that you know, you know who you are and aren't allowed to solicit or hire in the process. You know, I think that's an even bigger concern for industry buyers, but for financial buyers, it certainly applies as well. If there's somebody who particularly impresses you in the process, you know, you need to know that you won't be able to solicit them ordinarily for a year or two after signing the NDA. Okay, let's go to the next slide. And so, you know, in order to help facilitate the NDA review and to make the process a little smoother for everyone, Pulsinelli has created what we call the Smart NDA service. It is a systematized review of and bulk processing of NDAs. And so the goal here is to help you, get to an acceptable NDA outcome in a quicker and more efficient manner. And we can do this service for both buy side and sell side. So, you know, aligning with the hypothetical here, we'll talk about the buy side first. And so the service really mostly makes sense for serial acquirers. So if you're processing a bunch of NDAs on a, you know, daily basis or even, you know, a few a week, this service would probably be helpful and useful for you all. And so this is how it works. First of all, you know, you would engage Pulsinelli as your counsel to assist with the review. And then we would provide you with a matrix of commonly negotiated NDA terms. You know, this would include many of the things that Jessica talked about, the term, the retention of information, and the like. And then for each of those terms, we would go through with you and figure out what is your optimal outcome and what is your minimally acceptable outcome. And then as you receive NDAs from your potential targets, you would send those over to us and we would mark them up to align with your optimal outcome. That of course assumes that your conflict checks have been processed and cleared. And so we would mark it up with your optimal outcome. We'll send it back to the seller. And then, you know, we keep iterating through that process until we get to an agreed upon solution that falls within your minimally acceptable range. And to the extent that there's a sticking point and we can't get the seller to agree to something that is within that range and they're insisting on something that is outside of what you identified as minimally acceptable, we would obviously discuss that with you before making any changes beyond that. But that's how that process works. We've done this for a few different private equity firms. Sometimes it's, you know, reviewing 5, 6, 7 NDAs a day. And sometimes, like I said, it's just a few a week, but it is something that we've done successfully for a few different folks. And then on the other side of the transaction, we also help with a smart NDA service for the sell side process. So Catherine, if we can go to the next slide. Thanks. And so for this one, the process is slightly different. So, you know, the first step would be you all providing us with this is again, you as the seller. So, you know, you bought the company, it's done great. You're now selling it for 3x what you bought it for. You would provide us with a list of the names of potential buyers so we could run the conflicts. We would provide you with a form of NDA to be used in the process, and we would discuss any business-oriented terms to ensure that it matches with your expectations. Again, the idea is there is sort of to get a range of acceptable outcomes. Step four, this is an optional step, but sometimes we've annotated the form NDA, identifying a range of what we think are acceptable outcomes for more of the legal terms. And this comes in handy if the seller ends up reviewing the NDAs in-house, they sort of have a perspective on where they can and, you know, should and shouldn't accept for things that are more legal oriented. Then the NDAs go out to the prospective buyers, and as the markups come in, you would send them back to us, and we would revise those, again, in connection with the previously discussed range of acceptable outcomes. And then we would repeat that as the various NDAs come in.
Thank you, Michael. That sounds great. It just seems that you found a cost-efficient way, as well as a consistent process to get the same results for the clients.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. We found that it's both cost-effective and we're able to turn things a little quicker if we have, you know, a little upfront investment in terms of time spent on what is an acceptable range of outcomes.
That's great. Well, fast and cost efficient. Those are two things we're not usually known for. All right. Thank you, Michael. Now we're going to go over to Oliver Davies, who's a rising star associate in our Nashville office. Oliver, what are the key transaction structures to discuss with your attorneys?
Good afternoon, everybody, or good morning, depending on where you're at. There's, you know, at the end of the day, there's three general types of transaction structures that we're going to consider. And what my goal is for this portion of our presentation is to lay those three types out and to discuss the different levers that we're going to take into account when we're trying to evaluate and advise you all on what is the ideal structure for your proposed transaction. And this becomes a dialogue and a conversation between you and your counsel and your tax advisors to really come up with how do we solve this puzzle? How do we put into place the desire to acquire a certain business? What is the way that we can do it most efficiently so that you all can get on with running your business and creating value for your stakeholders? So the first thing is when we're looking at these different types of transaction structures, we're gonna look at three different levers that are gonna play a big role in what we're advising. Ultimately, it's gonna be tax, what are the liabilities of the target, and the logistics of how do we get the deal done. And that's gonna be both internal governance type logistics and third party consents or potential regulatory consents that we may need in order to affect the transaction and allow you to create the transfer of value that you're looking for. There are three primary types of deal structures, as I mentioned. You're going to have an asset purchase, an equity purchase, or a merger. And on the next few slides, we'll go through each one. But as we think through these three types of purchase structures, there may be different names for them, or there may be wrinkles or variations on a theme, or depending on how complicated the transaction is, you may see a structure where you have both an asset purchase and an equity purchase. Ultimately, where we want to get to, and I think it works most efficiently for all parties involved, is coming up with a transaction structure that is going to be graphically represented at some point. This will allow you, your counsel, your tax advisors to all look at the different steps of the transaction and be able to say, okay, this is how we are going to affect this deal. So for us, when we're working with our clients, we'll generally come up with either a PowerPoint deck or a Visio deck that lays out each step of the transaction. It'll show how we're going to transfer the business through the different steps of the process. There may be a pre-closing restructure. There may be a rollover component. We'll talk about rollover here in a second. That ultimately, when you can look at it visually or graphically depicted on paper, you're able to see, hey, we might need to tweak this lever here or tweak this lever there, because if we do a change for a tax reason, it might trigger a regulatory or a logistics reason. And so having those conversations early on with your counsel and your other advisors will make it efficient when it comes time to drafting the definitive documents, you know, as early as the letter of intent stage where you're outlining, here's how we're going to affect this transaction. A few moments ago, I mentioned rollover. A lot of times you'll see that the management team or some employees are going to roll over the equity that they have from the pre-closing entity into the new post-closing structure that you all are going to have a significant component of. That rollover component doesn't necessarily change our three structures. You can have a rollover component, rollover meaning that they're getting equity in the post-closing business in an asset deal, an equity deal. And when we get to a merger, what we'll talk about is how the merger consideration can be both cash and stock. And that'll impact our tax treatment, but it is all possible when we start to graft out these charts to see what they look like. So on the next slide, we'll talk about asset purchase agreements. So asset purchase agreements are kind of, if you think about it, like you're buying your house. You're going out and you're buying one big piece of an asset. It could be lots of different components of an asset, but ultimately you are going out and you are buying something from somebody else. There are certain tax benefits for you as a buyer and why you may want to buy assets, because you're likely going to get the step up in basis, which creates tax benefit for you as you depreciate the purchase price over time. Additionally, when you buy assets, you're able to pick and choose what you want. So in some businesses, there may be, you may have a founder team that has come together and brought multiple different parts of businesses together, created multiple different revenue streams, and you only want to take the one valuable revenue stream in that process. You can go in and you can say, I want this bundle of assets and I'm going to leave everything else behind. Also, when you buy assets, you're protected usually from successor liability. The idea being that you're buying certain assets and you're leaving liabilities behind. When your purchase agreement is structured, you're going to expressly exclude certain liabilities that you don't want a part of, that the sellers are going to stay responsible for in the process. Now, there are some cons to an asset transaction. Some of it is, if you're going in and you're buying, picking and choosing what assets you want, you may not capture everything that you need in that moment. You may say, I need all of these, leave these other assets behind, and 60, 90, 120 days after the transaction closes, you may realize, I need those assets too. So when you're doing an asset transaction, doing the diligence on what assets you need for the business is crucially important. Additionally, asset purchase agreements can be inefficient from a logistics standpoint. If your business is contract heavy and you're buying the contracts, that becomes an assignment where you may need to go to a third party to either give them notice that you're taking the contract or ask for their consent, or those contracts may specifically be prohibited from being assigned between the seller and that third party. And so you'll want to do that diligence early on to identify, are there any gating issues as it relates to third party logistics? With respect to internal governance, you'll want to look at the transaction or at the governing documents, whether it's bylaws, certificates of incorporation, any shareholder type agreements, operating agreements, to see if there's any restrictions in there as well. And finally, asset sales are going to be disfavored by sellers because they, one, want to get rid of the liabilities, and two, they don't get the benefit of the tax treatment that we talked about. So on the next slide, you'll see kind of the structure of what an asset deal looks like. On the left in the red boxes, need to see a doc. Big name capital is on the right. And you'll see cash goes from big name capital to need to see a doc for the assets that are coming back to big name capital. Now, typically, this is a simplified asset purchase structure. You would likely have a subsidiary that's buying the assets. But to keep our presentation simple today, very simple asset structure. On our next slide, we'll talk about equity purchases. This is like buying the membership interest or the stock of the company that owns that house that's using it as an Airbnb. You're going in, you're buying the company that owns the asset. Now, there are tax benefits here for the sellers. If structured correctly, they'll get the benefit of capital gains on the sale of their equity. This also has efficient logistics as it relates to those third-party contracts that we discussed. Where an assignment where you're buying and selling the contract, here you're not assigning the contract, you're changing who control of who owns the business that has that contract. Now, generally, you're gonna do the diligence to make sure that there's no change of control restrictions that would deem that change of control to be an assignment. But from a general standpoint for where we're at today, really becomes more efficient in that process. So some cons to an equity deal. Pre-closing liabilities, where we talked about in the asset deal that they stayed behind with the seller unless we assumed them, those pre-closing liabilities will come over with us when we buy the equity of the owner of that company. And then you have inefficiencies when it relates to internal governance or internal consents that are required. The more equity holders you have, the greater the risk that you have of a holdout. If I want to buy 100% of the equity and I have 100 shareholders on the cap table, one equity shareholder can mess up an entire deal. In fact, we're working on a transaction right now where the first conversation that we had with buyer's counsel was there's 8 shareholders. How do we know everybody's going to be able to or everybody's going to agree to sell? So as we're thinking through and looking at the cap structure, we want to know what is the execution risk? Is there the potential that somebody is going to be a holdout problem and drive up the time and the cost of the transaction? So on our next slide, you'll see the structure of an equity purchase where big name capital is going to purchase for cash the stock of Need to See a Doc or the membership interest of Need to See a Doc. That brings us to a merger. And so in a merger, what we are doing here is we are taking a legacy entity and merging it into a new co. There are potential benefits here for a merger for tax benefits. If structured correctly, you can do it for no tax. Additionally, there are potential for efficient logistics as it relates to the third-party contracts, as well as any equity owner holdout problem. A lot of times, there are statutory provisions that allow for less than unanimous consent in order to effect in a merger. And the merger agreement will then provide for remedies or provide for a dispute resolution if somebody dissents, but it still allows the transaction to move forward. There are some structuring cons. The liabilities, just like with the stock deal, are going to stay with that company. Now, there are a couple of different ways that you can think about a merger. You may have heard about a forward merger or a reverse triangular merger. The differences in those, I'll explain on the next slide where we show the structure for our merger. Here, this is a forward merger. We are taking Need to See a Doc and we are going to merge it into Big Name Capital's merger sub. Big Name Capital's merger sub is going to continue to be the entity that exists following the merger. What we will have given to members of Need to See a Doc will either be cash or stock. So they may have an ownership right going into it going in the future. They may not. But we did not include this slide, but just so you're aware, if you hear somebody saying a reverse triangular merger, we'll take Big Name Capital's merger sub, and merge it into Need to See a Doc. We will still control the ownership afterwards, but we can keep Need to See a Doc in place so that if there are regulatory concerns or if there are contracts that can't be assigned, we can keep the existing entity in place. So on the next slide, just a couple quick hypotheticals as it relates to our initial transaction considerations. These are the things that you're going to want to ask yourself when you're issue spotting or have conversations with your counsel about what are the assets of the target that are going to generate value? How do we get it out? How do we extract that value? And we do it in an efficient manner. What is the tax structure of the target? If the tax structure of the target is an S-corp, I highly recommend you go see your counsel and your accountants right away. It causes issues that you're going to want to be aware of and are going to drive ultimately what the structure looks like. How many equity holders are there? Are there lots of equity holders or one equity holder? Do we have those potential holdout problems? How quickly do we need to get to closing? And then ultimately, how much leverage does the seller have? Do we have the leverage to be able to drive structure to create the value that we're looking for from the tax benefit? Or is it something where there's going to be a give and take? Ultimately, there's a lot of things to consider in transaction structure. If you have questions, please feel free to reach out. I know it's a lot of information, but thanks for being here today.
Thanks, Oliver. Yeah, it's very important to start early and get all specialists involved in structure, since there's just so many different considerations. All right, so moving on. I'm going to discuss what are the key areas of a letter of intent to discuss with your attorneys. So first, let's briefly go over what is a letter of intent. It's just an agreement for an agreement, or outlining the understanding between the parties, with that such understanding being that the parties are going to enter into a formal or formalize a legal binding, legally binding agreement at a later date. So we got to examine what it actually goes into the letter of intent. And you're going to hear during my presentation for these things, what were the provisions there? Are we going to put in something vague, or are we going to put something specific in? So I want you to think about that as we go through this. First, there's usually a description of the transaction that the parties are intending to pursue. So for example, who's going to buy what and what type of consideration. Also, sometimes a buyer who's responding to an auction process will put in almost like a marketing piece on what they can bring to the table to sort of maybe hopefully highlight their LOI over others. Second, there's usually a timeline of the transaction, which can either be vague or specific on achieving certain milestones. Vague timeline would just say parties hope to close within 120 days. A specific timeline would set certain milestones with specific days or dates attached to them, like a buyer will produce a purchase agreement within 14 days after the LOI is signed. Then the purchase agreement will be signed within 30 days after the LOI is signed. Closing will happen 30 days thereafter. So what it does is it creates almost like a roadmap of different milestones so that each party can be accountable into moving through quickly to closing. Third, there's a preliminary statement of the basic deal terms. This can be in the LOI or attached as a separate sheet, and we'll get more into this later. Next, the LOI outlines expectations for the diligence process, including what the diligence period is extended to, when it ends, and what diligence the sellers will have to produce. There's also a section that's very important, which is on exclusivity. So that when you enter into an LOI with a target company or the sellers, that the sellers cannot talk with any other prospective buyers. This is different than usually with a NDA that we signed before, which doesn't have usually any exclusivity provisions. Finally, there's usually an allocations of fees and expenses. So if the buyer is going to pay for all the HSR fees or the R&W insurance premiums or any other sort of fee splitting, this is usually good to have in the LOI. Now let's go to the next slide. So what are the advantages and disadvantages of having an LOI? Because it's not mandatory to have one. So some advantages are you get to identify key business terms and material legal terms or deal breakers in the beginning of the process. This greatly sets expectations between the parties for the parameters of the negotiation. Although these deal terms are usually non-binding, the letter of intent is the roadmap for your attorneys in their negotiation. And having this roadmap laid out at the beginning of the process can greatly streamline negotiations of the agreement, and it may reduce time and costs of completing definitive agreements. Personally, one of my favorite things to include in LOIs is an indemnification limit and survival table, which can be easily referred to when drafting the documents, and everyone already has that agreed to before going to the definitive agreements. Also, another advantage is if each party puts time and resources into negotiating an LOI, this can show that both parties are committed to the process. Finally, like we said before, you can manage timing expectations with a timeline, and also very importantly, get the target under exclusivity provisions. Some disadvantages is that fully negotiating an LOI can be costly and expend time, resources when you don't have a definite time for closing. Also, before you've built up trust with the other party, trying to bring up some, you know, hot issues may hamstring future negotiating positions. Next slide. All right. So, as I mentioned before, LOI is an agreement to agree on terms later. So not everything in the LOI is binding. And let's take a look at what provisions in the LOI are binding and what are not. Substantive deal terms are generally non-binding, and they only serve as a roadmap for the attorney in drafting the document. But no party is bound to stick to what was agreed to in the LOI. However, it is seen as bound bad form to go back on what was already agreed in the LOI, unless for usually two reasons I see. New information emerges that lets the party renegotiate the deal terms, sort of like a due diligence issue coming up that the buyer wants to renegotiate either indemnification limits or purchase price. Another time that this happens is the targets or sellers sign an NDA without counsel. And then when my clients come to me with an LOI they already signed, first I ask, why didn't you call me? They say, well, we wanted to save money. And then I said, well, now I'm going to have to negotiate against this LOI for some of the more egregious terms that are just in there. And it sometimes ends up costing more money. So those are usually the two times that I see people going back on LOIs. The terms that are usually binding in the LOI are the process rules for the negotiation or expense provisions. Some example of these binding provisions are confidentiality, exclusivity, breakup fee, and governing law. It's important that in an LOI that you delineate what is binding and what is not. Just because these I say these are doesn't mean they're actually binding. You have to actually explicitly state it. All right, next slide. So for deal terms, you can either go, as I said, vague or specific. If you do specific, then you get to know exactly what you're getting into, and vague is, you know, just you want to have, you want to know what you're going to negotiate on later. So if you have vague terms, sometimes you say, well, we'll have customary closing conditions. This can be a trap though, because customary for one lawyer or one party is very different from the other. So just because you have it in there doesn't mean you're not going to fight later. There are certain deal terms, especially off-market deal terms, that are easier to negotiate in the LOI that you want to bring up. And also, if you... even if the deal term... I think that's it for that side. Move to the next. All right. One of the main reasons buyers like to have an LOI is to lock up the target company from negotiating with other parties while the deal documents and diligence are being conducted and when the real money is being spent. So that's why they have exclusivity provisions. The exclusivity is an agreement by one party, usually the seller, to not negotiate with anyone other than the other party, usually the buyer, for a set period of time. It is important to ensure that not only the target company and sellers are covered by the exclusivity, but also their affiliates and representatives. Buyers also want to have all seller parties have the duty to continue to negotiate in good faith. Otherwise, they can just wait until the exclusivity is over. So this is usually combined with a breakup fee. So if the seller parties breach this, buyers can recoup its costs. Extensions to this are usually automatic, so the exclusivity period keeps on going, unless the seller provides notice. All right, next slide. All right, so let's apply what we just learned to the hypothetical. Big name capital wants to close fast, so an outline of the transaction timeline should be inserted so that both parties can be held accountable to the timeline that's agreed. This should be specific down to the number of days for each milestone. And such timeline can be referred to easily during transaction update calls. due to the fact that big name capital wants to have certain sellers identify for more than their pro rata share, which is an off-market ask, this should also go in the LOI. Waiting to bring this issue up at a later date could either have a negative effect or make it so sellers can horse trade on another hot button issue. Due to the fast timeline, it would also be good to outline as many other deal terms in the LOI, so it would be less negotiation in the definitive documents. Also, the big name capital will want to include reasonable access to need to see a doc's employees and records so that they can finish their diligence in a timely manner. And also they want to negotiate a tight exclusivity provision because there are other people waiting in the wings to come in and swoop in and do a deal if this one fails. So it might also be smart to introduce a breakup fee so that if big name or if big name capital loses out because need to see a doc wants to walk, they will get their expenses paid for. Well, I hope you learned a little bit about what provisions you should put into the LOI today. And just remember when deciding that deciding what provisions to include in an LOI is really deal specific and should be discussed with your attorneys, or you may pay for it later. Thank you for joining us today. And thank you to all the presenters. And we hope to see you next week when we just dive into diligence issues on the telehealth deal. And we will continue the story with big name capital next week. Thank you.